From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So much of our lives is on Facebook, all the intimate details. You know what I'm talking about, relationship status, birthdays, all those likes. Well, Facebook is collecting everything and storing it all, and they're selling it to advertisers. The investigative journalists at ProPublica are digging into the volume and specificity of personal information that Facebook is gathering, and the findings are stunning. This hour on Point, what Facebook and big data know about you. You can join us on air or online. Does the amount of information Facebook collects about you bother you, frighten you? Is this just the cost of doing business in a free social media platform? Joining me first from Chicago is Julia Angwin, senior investigative reporter for ProPublica. Her multi-part series, Breaking the Black Box, begins with a look at what Facebook knows about you. And you can find a link to the series at our website, onpointradio.org. Julia, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So you spent the last year studying big data, specifically investigating algorithms, which is a fairly wonky topic, but you've made it very interesting. Explain to us first exactly what an algorithm is.
Thank you for talking to me about algorithms. It is totally wonky, and I'm so happy that people actually care about them. Algorithms are really, at their simplest level, just a recipe. It's instructions. So if you cook, when you use a recipe, that's an algorithm. But what we mean today when we talk about algorithms is mostly computers and the instructions they have for giving us data or computing data about us. And so I wanted to look into the situation of how we don't understand how computers make decisions, how they're making those judgments, how did they decide that this ad would follow us around the internet and that one wouldn't. And so that's what our investigative series has been about, how these judgments are made about us.
And so you did this deep dive into the secret algorithms of big tech companies like Facebook. What were you trying to figure out about how Facebook uses these algorithms?
So we were trying to illuminate more what Facebook, what we know about what Facebook has, because in truth, we can't really see everything. And that's why we call it Breaking the Black Box. And that's maybe more of a goal, because the truth is these are these companies like Facebook, their algorithms are their trade secrets. They're not going to tell us how they decide, for instance, which items go into your news feed higher than others, right? They've only said it's a computer algorithm. They recently said we're not going to have humans involved anymore because their judgments were biased. So we were trying to figure out a way to look at that algorithm without being able to see it. So what we did was we thought, well, we do know that they tell you a little bit about what they know about you, but we don't have a sense of how much that really is, because you know, you can just sort of see what they know about you individually. So we built a tool that people can use, install on their Chrome web browser, and it illuminates everything that Facebook has told you about what it knows about you. And sometimes it's a really long list. It could be 160 or 200 items per person. And what we're doing is asking people to contribute all that data to us, and we've already amassed a list of 50,000 unique attributes that Facebook has assigned to people. So we're getting a sense of how granular their data is. And that, at the end, we're going to publish that and help people see, wow, they're putting us in pretty small boxes here.
So Facebook is a data juggernaut. I mean, as you have written, they have a particularly comprehensive set of dossiers on 2 billion users. Tell us exactly what they know about us.
So what they know is, first, they know what you did on Facebook, which is obvious, right? Mm-hmm. You go on, you have friends, you do posts, you mm-hmm. like things, et cetera. So that part is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. I think what people might not know is that they also know what you do off Facebook across the internet, because on almost all the pages that have a little button for Facebook sharing or some other type of Facebook login, that on those pages, Facebook knows you're there when you're there. If you're a Facebook member, which 2 billion people are, they can see you as you browse the web. And then additionally, they actually buy data from offline data brokers about you. So, for instance, your mortgage, your car ownership, property size, credit lines, things like that, which you can get from these big offline data brokers. And they are in a unique position to do this because they know everyone's real name. They have a real name policy, and they forced you to use it. Google has a little disadvantage here, because if you search on Google, they don't always know exactly who you are. So Facebook has built up like this very strong competitive advantage with its data.
So, but you say that they're buying commercial data from data brokers on everything from your shopping habits to car ownership to mortgage information. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So your examination of the 100 most popular Facebook apps found that many of them seek email addresses, your location, your sexual preference of not only the app users, but also of your friends who are using Facebook. So they're not just gathering your information, they're gathering your community's information.
Yes, that's right. And one thing that's important to remember is that we all think we're extremely unique, but we are like our friends. And so to understand who our friends and who our social network is actually one of the most revealing things you can know about a person.
So you say the voraciousness of this data collection suggests that big tech companies collect the information because they can and then figure out what to do with it later. Is that part of this calculus?
Yeah, I think right now we're in sort of a data land grab where all the big tech companies are collecting as much as they can, and they don't necessarily know what they're going to do with it. You know, for instance, some of the categories that we've seen Facebook has assigned users to are kind of absurd. You know, people who like grass or people who like the concept of concept or people who like wax. I don't think there are advertisers out there buying those categories right now. So they don't need to know that. That's not a category they're mm-hmm. selling. But it's kind of like, why wouldn't you want to know that? Because in the future, you might actually want to know who's interested in grass.
So you found that Facebook offers advertisers more than 1,300 categories for ad targeting. Is that right?
Yeah. So when you go in as an advertiser to Facebook, you pull up a little list of categories where you basically say, I want to buy an audience that looks like this. And you can very clearly delineate what categories you want, from ethnic affinity to credit lines to interests such as, you know, I'm interested in looking for a house. And those interests might be generated by pages you liked on Facebook or websites you visited on the web. So they can sell a kind of very granular portrait of you and an audience that basically no one else can deliver that kind of granularity.
Are most Facebook users aware of the sophistication and the scope of this data collection and how this information is being used?
I don't think so. I mean, we thought when we launched this browser extension just a few weeks ago that it was mostly just information. It would sort of enhance what people already knew. But we were surprised how many people were shocked at the level of data collection. Certainly the details that we got were surprising. But the fact that they're so voracious about data collection, I didn't think would be as surprising at this point in their evolution, but it still does seem to surprise people.
So you said something earlier that caught my ear. It's not just when you're using Facebook or an app that Facebook owns, which are many, but when you're browsing the web. Is that right? You're shopping, you're on various websites. They can track that as well?
Yes, that's right. They turned that on about 2 years ago. They announced that they would start tracking people by name across the web. You know, only if you're a Facebook member, which is most people. Previously, most of those ads that follow you around on the web and that are creepy, they are creepy, but they actually usually don't know your name, right? So this was a new level because Facebook usually already knew you because you logged in, and they already had their technology on many websites because a lot of websites want Facebook functionality on it. So they decided to combine those two things so they could really see everyone's actions. And truthfully, that is a big deal because in 2000, Google tried a company called DoubleClick, which is now part of Google, tried to do that where it said it was going to merge people's names with their web browsing information. And everyone erupted and they had to back off of their plan. But it just shows how far we've come that people didn't even blink this time.
Here's Jay Park, Vice President of Design and Construction at Facebook. That means he's a data center design architect. Here he is in a video posted on Facebook's YouTube page.
So when you think about the Facebook, everything that you actually do, the data goes through our data center, right? So data center is the focal point of the data transmitting or receiving.
So tell us why this all matters, Julia Angwin. I mean, you've spent a year looking into all this. What's the big deal? So who cares? They've got all this information. I mean, we know it. We're putting it out there. We're on Facebook. It's a free social media site. So what?
I think that's a great point. You know, honestly, right now, the so what is mostly that you get a bunch of targeted ads, which are annoying and creepy. And I don't blame anyone for saying, hey, that's not a bad price to pay for the great functionality that I get. But the challenge we have, I think, as a society is that we have never allowed anyone to get this amount of data on our citizens. I think Facebook may well have more than the government on everybody. And we don't have any laws that really limit what they can do with that data. We're the only Western nation that doesn't have a baseline commercial privacy law that limits what big data brokers can do. In most Western countries, those companies that gather data on individuals have to give people access to their information so they can see what data is being collected about them. And correction rights, meaning if it's wrong, they can correct it. Mm-hmm. Often deletion mm-hmm. rights, removing themselves from those databases. These sort of basic rights, we have not passed those in this country. We also haven't passed any sort of laws preventing the data from being shared. I say this as a joke because I don't think it would happen. But in fact, Facebook could sell all this data to Russia tomorrow. If they wanted to, right? They would do one of these like privacy policy updates, which no one ever reads. Everyone would agree. And they could do it. So we have a situation where the potential for abuse is high and the oversight is low. And so for me as a journalist who is a watchdog, I think that that is the concern I have, is that we need to know how specific this data is to really get a sense of, well, how much do we want to regulate it?
About 30 seconds left here before we go to break. What surprised you most about your reporting, Julia?
I think what surprised us most is that so far, we haven't finalized our results yet, but so far we haven't seen a one-to-one correlation between what Facebook sells to advertisers and what Facebook says it knows about you. So there's a possibility they're not actually telling you everything that they sell about you.
So much to get into here. We're just getting started. We're talking about Facebook's gigantic system of personal data collection. And you can join the conversation. Do you know what Facebook thinks you like? Do you care? Do you ever think about those very specific targeted ads on your feed? I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll have much more after this break. Stick with us. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Facebook and its massive big data collection operation. We're speaking this hour with Julia Angwin, senior investigative reporter for ProPublica. Her multi-part series, Breaking the Black Box, begins with a look at what Facebook knows about you. I should say we reached out to Facebook for a response in this hour, and we did not hear back. I want to play this. 6 years after Facebook was launched, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said in a 2010 interview that sharing information online is becoming the new social norm, and the purpose of Facebook is to reflect such social norms through innovation.
People have really gotten comfortable not only sharing more information and different kinds, but more openly with more people. And that social norm is just something that's evolved over time. And we view it as our role in the system to constantly be kind of innovating and updating what our system is to reflect what the current social norms are.
Let me bring in another voice now from New York City, Kathy O'Neill, a mathematician, data scientist, and author of the new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So you used to work in this field, big data. First tell me what drew you into this work and later what drew you away.
Well, I was a mathematician by training, and I wanted to learn how to, you know, use my smarts in business. And I actually originally went into finance as a quant, and I entered there in 2007, just in time to see the world fall apart. I was actually trying to like get away from what I considered corrupt practices, and I didn't want to be a part of that scene. So I left finance. I actually joined Occupy soon after that. But in the meantime, I needed a day job, so I became a data scientist at a startup in New York City, doing tailored advertising, much like we see on Facebook.
Mm. And so, well, you write that in the age of the algorithm that we're in a techno-utopia, and you don't mean that in a good way. Tell us what techno-utopia is.
Yeah, I mean, look, techno-utopia is basically the idea that this is all good, that all the things that are happening here are win-wins. And to some extent, that's actually true. Like when a payday lender or a for-profit college preys on people through tailored advertising because they can sort of use the machinery of tailored advertising to find exactly their targets, that is a win-win in the sense that Facebook or Google gets paid for that advertising and those recruiting mechanisms find their targets. But it's not actually necessarily a win for the public itself. So what we're seeing is there's actually kind of three stakeholders here, and two of them are winning and one of them isn't.
And who isn't?
Basically, the people who are preyed upon. You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, a large part of why I wrote the book, was when a venture capitalist came to visit my company, my startup in New York City, and he painted a picture of the future of tailored advertising. And he said, I can't wait for the day when all I see are trips to Aruba and jet skis, and I never again have to see another University of Phoenix ad, because those aren't for people like me. And the people around me actually laughed at that. And you know, what I realized at that moment was that this is like a very deliberate construction of the internet as a place where we are segmented and siloed and segregated into little boxes, little marketing profiles by class and by race and by everything that, you know, all the usual stratas. And, you know, what is a service for us? And I should say that most of the advertisements I see on Facebook personally are kind of offers. They're services. Like, mm-hmm. I get to see my favorite yarn brand, and I'm a big knitter, so that's exciting. But what's a service for me as a technologist, as an educated person with extra cash in my pocket, is actually not at all something that somebody at the other end of the spectrum would enjoy or benefit from.
In fact, you say this all creates a, quote, toxic cocktail for democracy itself, this dark side of big data. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, two things. First of all, as I say, like, payday lenders and for-profit colleges are predatory industries that feast on vulnerable people who are in particular eligible for financial aid, so poor people. But there's another thing that's happening, not just to those people, but to all of us, which is the way that information is meted out to us by spoonfuls. And I'm thinking in particular by political micro-targeting campaigns, campaigns like Hillary's campaign. More Hillary's than Trump's, actually, in this election cycle, but it was started by Obama. These guys know more about us than anyone else, practically, than possibly Facebook. And they actually target us very individually, not to give us, you know, broad information, to be clear, but to give us exactly the information that they want us to hear. And that's a problem for the entire society at large. We need to be civically informed, and micro-targeting campaigns do not do that for us.
You just heard Mark Zuckerberg say, you know, people have gotten comfortable not only sharing more information, but different kinds of information, that people are more open. This is a social norm that's evolving over time. And yet you're saying that there are many people who, well, I guess don't know how to opt out of these categories if they want to. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, what he's doing is he's obscuring the cost that we're all paying when we give our private information away. And that cost is still catching up with us. There's a lag between when that social norm came into practice, which was arguably in the last 10 years, and like what's actually happening to our society. When we think about hyperpartisanship, we think about the Facebook algorithm, not just the advertisements, to be clear, but the actual newsfeed algorithm that basically has been designed to keep us mollified, to keep us staying on Facebook and happy to read the things that we want to hear, rather than giving us really an informed view. So what he's talking about, first of all, is a lag. So he's saying, oh, this is okay, but we actually haven't figured out if it is okay. So number one. Mm-hmm. But number two, he hasn't really talked about who it's okay for. And I would argue that the very people who are most vulnerable, who get preyed upon the most, are those people that don't have sort of the extra time and the required education to actually protect themselves and protect their privacy.
Julie Angwin,
so that's a real problem.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Julie Angwin, after a year of investigating big data, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with it. I mean, I spent a year trying to protect my privacy. I wrote a book about it in 2014, and I tallied up what it cost me in time and money to truly put in like the basic protections. I spent $2,500, and I spent months of my own personal time putting in, you know, using various software and setting up fake identities and all sorts of stuff. And I think that that's not a reasonable thing to ask anyone to do. And in fact, what my book was about was like, no one should do this. We should change the situation so that you don't have to do this amount of defense. Mm.
I've got a line of calls around the block here. Let's get first to Lexington, Kentucky. Shotzi is on the line. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
I am actually in the category of advertiser with Facebook.
Okay.
And, I mean, advertiser is a slight misnomer, because I run a page about climate change and I have about 400,000 followers. But the thing of it is that there is a barrier or a membrane, I would say, between what Facebook gathers in terms of their data and what they share with their advertisers, who would be people like me. We basically have no access to it. We get like very generalized information, but nothing that, in my opinion, that's actually useful. You know, you can't drill down into it. They basically, you as an advertiser, pay for the visibility. And then I suspect Facebook just gets the benefit of the data that you're generating.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting, Shotzi. Thank you. So, Julia Angwin, it's a one-way share. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that is true. Both Google and Facebook have set it up that way. And the reason is that they have really a monopoly on the granular data on their users. So they don't need to share it. In fact, it's a bad idea for them business-wise. They just lease out access to it, right? And that is so they definitively aren't going to share it right now. But I do think that we have to think about government access to it, right? This is an important topic. The government is like very excited about how granular this data is and, you know, how often are they knocking at the door for extremely granular information about how many people of certain ethnic affinities have ever expressed an interest in a certain topic.
Hmm. Mike in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm also like the last caller. I'm a Facebook advertiser, and my comment was basically about the same. You know, when we advertise on Facebook, we can get the, you know, general user data, and Facebook is very good at actually giving us people that are like the customers that we want, and they're, my interaction with them anyway has been excellent in terms of, you know, being able to target who I want. And at the end of the day, it ends up saving us money and saving us time. And so I think having the data available is great. And like the last caller said, it is a one-way thing, and we never get that personally identifiable information until a user chooses to interact with us and chooses to like our page or buy our product.
So does it bother you at all, this detailed personal information that they're taking, and who knows what they're doing with it, Mike?
Actually, Jane, it doesn't, because I've always felt for the longest time that I think by using the internet and by using Facebook, and maybe I'm one of these kind of millennial mindsets that our data is already given up. I have no privacy. Once I get online and start sharing on Facebook, I should assume that no matter what my privacy settings are, that my status can be shared and copied and used against me in the future, or used for me in the future, or anything I do online, on a website, on Facebook, on Google, on anything. I feel like my privacy is already forfeit.
Mike, thank you. Kathy O'Neill, I'll let you jump in here. What about that? Mike says, you know, I just assume my status is out there. Once I'm online, I've kind of given it up.
Well, two things. First of all, I would like to, reiterate that what Mike is saying is exactly what I was imagining he would say, that this is actually a win-win for the advertisers and for Facebook, right? They don't see a problem with this system. In fact, the more information they give to Facebook, the more Facebook understands about their customers and what their customers' needs, or customers being the advertisers, and the more that they can focus and partition and segment the users of Facebook. So it's like a system that's getting more and more refined, and it's working for the advertisers and for Facebook. And the question should be then, is it working for the rest of us? As for his issue of like forfeiting his privacy, I would argue that, you know, it's all a question of like who you are and what the chances are that that data will actually be used against you, and what are the risks to your own security and your family if it is. The problem is that we live in a very unequal society. So somebody who is, you know, a well-to-do, educated white person, man with college education, has a lot less at risk for advertising and for that kind of environment than like a poor single mother, black, who's being targeted by a for-profit college. And so It's a question of not just like whether their privacy is gone, but what does that mean for us when it is gone?
Bob is in Hartfield, Virginia. Bob, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, I'm looking at it as a consumer, and having them have information on me is actually kind of very good for me as well.
How so, Bob? How so?
I'll give you an example. I read books. I read a lot of books. And I can go to either Barnes & Noble, where basically nobody knows me and there are lots of employees and I'm left alone to browse through books on my own. But I choose to go to a little bookstore where it's the owner and a couple of employees, and they all know me. And when I walk in, if there's an author that they know I've bought before and they've come out with a new book, they'll let me know.
So you want the same thing online. Is that what I'm hearing? You like that?
I really do like that. And when I'm online, if I see an ad for a guitar store, well, that's kind of good because I am interested in guitars.
Bob, thank you. So Julia and Gwen, speak to that. I mean, Bob says, you know, they're targeting me. They know what I like and it makes it easier for my life.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that people want customized recommendations. The question is, what are the boundaries that are put on that? If I think a lot of people have forgotten, but during the Cold War, the FBI was going to libraries and asking librarians to turn over records of who had checked out books about Russia. And librarians across the nation banded together and said, you know what, reading is confidential. And so we are not going to turn over library records to the government. And almost every state passed a law protecting the confidentiality of library records. And I think that's where we're at right now, which is like, I guess a lot of people have somehow made their peace with this idea that everything is available online and they have no privacy. But I think that it's worth remembering that this nation has chosen a different path in the past. We have walled off things that we thought were inappropriate. And library records are exactly the same as what you read online. It's just as revealing.
Kathy O'Neill, in your book, Weapons of Math Destruction, you give a lot of examples where big data has not lived up to its promises. Give us one example of that, where that has happened and, in fact, made things worse.
Yeah. So thank you. I do want to make the point that I am not anti-algorithm because I think there's lots of really good algorithms. And like I like getting recommended books that I like as well. But I wrote in Weapons of Math Destruction, I defined very carefully the concept of an algorithm that we should all be worried about, which I call a weapon of math destruction. It's characterized by the fact that it's highly scaled, it's secret, and it's destructive. And one of the most important examples, I think, comes from policing, predictive policing, which uses arrest records to decide where to send police. And the problem with that is that we have an uneven and racially biased policing system. So when we take historical data to look for where the arrests occurred, it's in over-policed, poor Black neighborhoods. And then we send police back to those same neighborhoods and we call it scientific. But it's not actually scientific. It's just creating a feedback loop based on biased data. And that's based, again, on biased policing. So what I'm arguing for in the book is that, first of all, we should be much more careful about what are the consequences of this data collection and that who is it affecting the most.
This is a promotional video for Facebook Business posted on YouTube in 2014 talking about how to target advertising based on interest, on location, device, and more.
Choose from options like age, gender, location, and their interests. You can even reach people by the specific device they use to check Facebook, like computers, phones, and tablets. And using partner categories, we can help you understand what people like to do off Facebook too. Like if they want to buy a car or shop for premium pet food.
Julia Angwin, before we get a break here in our next 30 seconds or so, I'm just curious, knowing what you know, spending the last year looking at big data, how do you use social media? How do you manage all of this?
Oh, that's a great question. I basically don't use Facebook. I have a profile, but I unfriended everybody because I don't think as a journalist it's a good idea to have all of my contacts and sources or potential sources available to the public or to Facebook. I do use Twitter, though, and I've deleted my LinkedIn account.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at big data, algorithms, and what Facebook knows about you and what it's doing with all that knowledge. You can join the conversation. Where is all this data stored? Can you imagine if it was hacked? In this advertisement for Facebook Business, the CEO of a global children's brand called Little Passports talks about how they used targeted ads to figure out where to grow internationally. This video was posted on YouTube.
Facebook allows us to test in small amounts and target each country and figure out quickly which work for us. We were looking to see whether we could sell a subscription on Facebook for a cost that was attractive to us. And so when we hit that cost target, we knew that a specific country worked for us.
We've been speaking this hour with Julia Angwin, senior investigative reporter with ProPublica and co-author of the ongoing series on big data and machine learning there, Breaking the Black Box. The final chapter of the series, How Machines Learn to Be Racist, published today. And Kathy O'Neill, author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. I should say we reached out to Facebook for a response for this hour and we did not hear back. Let me bring in now via Skype from Boulder, Colorado, Ashkan Soltani, the former chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission, where he served in the Division of Privacy and Identity Protection. He's now an independent researcher and consultant in privacy and data security. Ashkan, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So where is all this big data stored?
So that's a really great question. I think part of the challenge here isn't just the use of the information, it's the collection and storage of the information. And I think that's, you know, as the callers called in and claim they have no issue with that information being used for, say, the purpose of targeted advertising, I think a lot of people might have issue if that information is used for other reasons, right? We've seen companies that use this type of information to help make creditworthiness decisions or employment decisions, whether you're able to, for example, get a job. Just this summer, a company, Thomson Reuters, had a list of individuals that they consider at risk for banks. They call it the World Checklist, and it's essentially a list of people that might be involved in money laundering, corruption, even terrorism that they sell. That list was hacked and leaked online, right? And so that information then becomes available to anyone that might want to use that to make determinations about those individuals, which I think is the problem.
So anything's possible. I mean, this big data, of course, could be hacked. Of course, we've seen hacking in this presidential campaign. Why not hacking at Facebook?
That's right. That's right.
So some people don't mind the big data collection. For others, there's sort of a creepy factor here, you know, sort of unsettling to see a very specific ad appearing on your feed. How do you see it?
So I kind of would break it up. So there's the use of the information, which is the showing of ads. But I would kind of focus more on the actual collection of the information. And some people don't mind the collection of information. Your caller earlier said, when you use the internet, you know, your data is out there. And that may be so, but part of the issue we want to kind of unpack is that some of this data is actively shared, the information you share by actively using Facebook or actively making posts. But a lot of this data is passive collection from things like the sites you visit or the mobile phone in your pocket and the places you visit. So Facebook, for example, has partnerships with companies like Walgreens and CVS that will link your purchases in store with what ads you've seen online, right? And so they're able to say if you've seen an ad for a razor, they can say how many of those people that saw that ad purchase the razor, right? And so that type of passive collection where people aren't aware of it and aren't explicitly sharing it, I think that's where we start getting up to the creepy line.
So some of this big data mines your social media activity to figure out personality traits. For example, if you have racist tendencies. I mean, talk about the profiles that emerge in all this.
Right. So I think one of the companies was Social Intelligence that tries to look to see if you use racist words or your posts are vulgar in some sense, and will sell that information to would-be employers. Right. And so I think people might be misled by thinking, oh, this is just an advertising ecosystem and that data is exclusively used for advertising, and it's not, right? And I think some companies are good about only leasing access to advertisers, but other companies will sell and provide this information to, as I said, creditworthiness or employers,
et cetera. So can algorithms predict behavior offline?
I mean, I think the goal of the maximization, a lot of the cross-device tracking is to understand when you show an ad, when you can drive someone to a movie theater, or when you can drive someone to go purchase something in store. And so that type of kind of optimization is occurring, right? So the ads are trying to say, Julia's likely to go buy some razors in the middle of the night in New York, so I'm going to show her an ad around 9 o'clock when she gets off work, or something like that. Mm. I'm assuming you're a workaholic, Julia. So.
So, Ashkin, there is no law right now that says an employee cannot buy web tracking information on a potential employee. I mean, you talk about employees. There are, I mean, it's
employer,
yeah. Right? I mean, it's open field. There are no privacy laws on this point. Very little oversight.
There are laws with regards to kind of employee information, and so we have the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and we have laws regarding what information companies sell about individuals with regards to credit decisions and with and employment decisions. The challenge is that some of this information and those companies that do it explicitly kind of self-regulate or fall under these rules, but there's a lot of other firms that are trying to essentially find proxies for the same information that fall outside of this regulation.
What do you mean proxies for information?
So the idea is like if I explicitly sell information that I know is being used for making credit decisions, I fall under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But if I sell information like what kind of car you might like, mm-hmm. Or what kind of car or house you might be in the market for, that doesn't fall under that regulation. But the individual purchasing that information will be able to still tell your potential income bracket from that information. Mm. Right. So it's a proxy for your wealth or for your income.
So interesting. Let's get another call in here. John in Willett, New York. Willett, John, thanks so much for calling.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for, taking me on point. Yeah, I don't have the name of the person, the ProPublica person.
Uh-huh, Julia Engwin, uh-huh.
Yeah, Julia, because I'm going to research this later. But I guess this is going to be kind of I'll try to make it brief. We're living in what I call the consumer-based petrochemical nuclear industrial age, which in itself is actually a calamity. It's not being prevented, and they're still building refineries and chemical plants and so on. So, being said, as far as this technology, techno utopia, or the toxic cocktail, or I'm just a basic Facebook user, if you will. I'm not a scientist or whatever, but I do pay attention, and it is a little unnerving that the government or whoever can get information that you might not want them to have. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you're a person that has integrity, then you don't have to worry about it. I mean, really, you're not doing anything wrong, so why should you have to worry?
So if you've got nothing to hide, so what? I get it, John. Thank you. Let's go to Walter. Hear what you have to say, Walter, in Jamestown, New York. Glad to have you on.
Yes, thank you.
Hi.
Appreciate you taking my call.
Yes.
I'm a freelance writer, and I have done work for literally hundreds of clients on hundreds of different topics. So whatever is out there in terms of what looked like it might be my preferences online have nothing at all to do with me. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't mind sometimes ads targeted to me, but I get the strangest combination of ads because of what it looks like I'm interested in. But even it's a little scary on that issue, though, is that I've recently started working on a memoir for someone which has to do with Cold War espionage. And I was warned that if I Google certain names, I'm going to be flagged with the CIA and the FBI and perhaps others I couldn't even name. And in fact, I did Google one name that the client gave me, and within a day I started getting ads in Russian.
That's interesting.
Marshall McLuhan called it the global village. We've invented it. We just haven't invented door locks and property fences yet.
Walter, thanks so much for the call. Julie Engwin, Facebook requires apps to ask permission before accessing a user's personal information, but a user's friends aren't notified if the data is used. Is that right? Just to confirm.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And so is Facebook enforcing its own rules on data privacy and all of this?
You know, that's a good question. Back several years ago when I was at the Wall Street Journal, we did some stories about how Facebook wasn't enforcing its rules on its app makers and, in fact, was allowing them to take much more data than they were allowed. At that time, they cleaned it up. I haven't checked since then, but that's often a problem. So any study that's ever been done about apps, so on your phone, there's been studies pretty much every year that show many apps are stealing data beyond what they're supposed to. And this is the problem. A lot of these companies like Facebook and Apple and Google are supposed to police their app ecosystems, but it's very difficult for them to really get on top of all these hundreds of thousands of apps and what they might be stealing.
You talk about the fact that algorithms are, quote, biased. What do you mean by that?
So algorithms are basically neutral. They're just math, but they can return biased outcomes. So, for instance, if you feed a bunch of biased data, like Kathy was talking about with predictive policing, right? Arrests are, we know in a lot of police jurisdictions, are very biased towards minority communities. And you feed that into a system and say, create an algorithm where to predict where future arrests will be, it's going to definitely over-predict in minority communities because that's where the data came from. And so that's how bias fits in. We built an engine today actually to show exactly how bias works, an artificial intelligence engine that's up on ProPublica's website. And we trained this algorithm on different data sets, so in the on like left-leaning media and right-leaning media. And you can see there are different words that are generated. It's a synonym generator. So on the left, for instance, when you put in the word abortion, one of the top synonyms is contraception. On the right-leaning media, one of the top synonyms is late term, as in late term abortion. And so you can see that when you train an algorithm on different data sets, it's going to learn different things.
Back to the phones. Puneet is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I am a data analyst, and I have worked for banks and travel companies doing exactly what people are complaining against. And I realized a long time back that once you are online or on the grid, then everybody knows everything about you. Mm-hmm. So if people are concerned about advertisements following them around, I have a simple solution that what I do all the time. I spend 5 minutes clicking all kinds of random stuff.
Okay.
Right? That gives them wrong data. Secondly, when companies send me things in the mail, I spend maybe half an hour every other week or every month stuffing those envelopes with junk and sending it all back to them. See, you have to realize that all these companies give money to Google because the return on their investment is high. The moment the return on this investment starts to disappear, we will not have all this kind of ads.
Puneet, thank you. That's so interesting. So, Kathy O'Neill, what Puneet is doing is he's creating fake profiles, right? He's fighting back, putting in, you know, wrong data, if you will, into the algorithm so they don't really know who he is, Kathy.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's common. And I think it says a lot about our industry that the people inside the industry are the most paranoid. And it's, I think it's same is true for like ex-NSA people. They're very, very much off the grid. That means that the industry, there's a problem, right? I personally do not do that. And one of the reasons I don't, I use Facebook a lot. I use Twitter. I use everything. And partly because I want to see what happens. You know, I want to experience what's happening to the average person. Because again, I would make the argument that although the caller has time to do that, most people don't have time to do that, don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the most vulnerable among us absolutely do not know what to do, nor do they cover their tracks whatsoever. So we can't have a system in which we say, okay, we're all good if we can pay for privacy, and it costs a lot in terms of money and time, and then we'll just let the people who are most vulnerable just deal with the consequences. I think that's insufficient. I would, if you don't mind, I'd like to respond to one thing one of the callers said, which is that, you know, we have not only do we have unprecedented data collection and analysis, but we also have like techniques in data science that are constantly evolving and getting better and better. So what that means is that we can take data as a data scientist. I could take data that's like 10 years old and infer from what you posted on Facebook 10 years ago, if Facebook even existed 10 years ago, I can infer things that they couldn't do 10 years ago. So in other words, this data collection, the fact that this data is here and it's staying here and the techniques are getting better and better means that we don't actually even know what can be done with our data. It's getting better all the time.
You know, I asked Julia, I'd like to ask the other two guests, knowing what you know about big data, how it's collected, how it's used, how do you use social media? Kathy O'Neill, do you use it?
I use it a lot, and I don't protect myself, and I keep an eye on the kinds of ad preferences that they think I want. I look at, you know, Axiom is a big data warehousing company. They show us some things about us that they think they know, and I check that out a lot because I want to know how good this technology has become, and I think the best way of figuring that out is to keep an eye on it as individuals.
Askin Sultani, how do you use social media? Do you use it?
I do use social media. For me, it goes back to the point I made earlier, which is trying to control the passive collection and then be open about what I want to collect. So I want to share. So I try to often, I don't run apps on my phone, social media apps on my phone. I try not to allow things that passively collect my information. So if I want to post from my phone, I open Facebook in a browser. I'll post on Facebook or I'll post on Twitter. And at that moment, I'm explicitly allowing that site to know where I am and what information I'd like to share, and then I close that up. And so for me, a lot of it is trying to break the bond between the information that's collected when I don't want it to be collected and the information I want to explicitly share.
Well, an eye-opening hour for sure. Many thanks to a terrific panel, Askin Sultani, independent researcher and data security expert. Thanks so much for your time, Askin.
Thank you.
Kathy O'Neill, author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, thanks for your insights.
Thanks, Jane.
And Julia Angwin, senior investigative reporter for ProPublica. Thanks so much for speaking with us and for your year-long investigation into big data. And I should say, the plug-in for the downloadable, if folks want to join you in this investigation, is on our website, onpointradio.org. Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.